Recently, I heard one of the most fascinating stories I've ever heard about the issue of race in America. It was while attending the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship's spring gathering of Kentucky. And there I heard and met Harvey Coulon. Harvey is a black African from the Congo. He's about 6'6", I guess his height, because I've spent over 10 years watching Raleigh Kincaid, but somewhere about the Raleigh Kincaid height is Harvey, who is now a coach at Campbellsville University with basketball, finishing a master's degree. But he had moved to America a few years ago to attend Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And he needed to travel from Hanover to Atlanta, and so he bought a Greyhound bus ticket to make the journey. And it was somewhere around Richmond, Virginia, that the bus stopped for gas and allowed the travelers to have some lunch. And he walked into this barbecue joint, and for the very first time in his life, he was in a room surrounded with a majority of African Americans, as many as 30 or 40 of them in that room. And he realized immediately that he felt afraid and wondered why this very insecure feeling had come washing all over him. Why, walking into this room of African Americans, did he feel so uncertain, so suspicious, so afraid? Harvey, a very introspective, reflective, intelligent soul, did something very wise, practicing a deep spiritual discipline that he had participated in over and over in his growing up years. He forgot about lunch. He left the restaurant, sat on the curb, and had a little talk with God, asking that question: why did I feel so much fear and anxiety? Knowing that the Spirit of God lives in him, and that the Spirit of God is a spirit not of fear, but of love. And so he wrestled in his soul and his mind about this experience of feeling afraid around African Americans. He remembered how, growing up in Africa, being fascinated with American culture, especially American TV shows and movies. And he began to realize that all those years watching all those TV programs and all those movies, that his understanding of African Americans had been conditioned how they were portrayed in those TV shows and movies he had watched over and over again as a child and as a teenager. And how, in the vast majority of these presentations, African Americans were represented by characters who were very violent or angry or extremely emotional and often disagreeable. What he had learned about the community of African Americans was not forged because he perhaps looked like them or from actual relationships or authentic interactions, but from the way they were depicted in culture, in movies, in TV shows. A presentation that instilled within him a bias against a people that the white community would probably lump together as his very own, being conditioned by race and the cultural and ethnic associations around it. It's just that tricky and deceptive. And in our reading from Romans chapter 8, I believe we see the Apostle Paul in a theological discourse also needing to address his own prejudice, a bias that he lived first against the Jews who were professing the name of Jesus, and then against the non-Jewish or Gentile world in their confession of this Jesus. That this prejudice that Paul had to address had to be dealt with before he could be the great apostle, the great ambassador, commissioned and called by God to the world. And in Romans 8, he reveals to us that this new orientation was a gift of the Spirit. Now maybe we remember a little bit about Paul's journey, his life experience in Acts. We remember how the unseen God had revealed God's self to Paul in the risen Christ, blinding him on the Damascus road, and then miraculously granting his sight through the Spirit with new eyes. Eyes that were not controlled by a dominant ethnic or cultural bias, that were not blurred by fear or uncertainty or distrust. Eyes that would not continue to be blind to the presence of God showing up in surprising and unexpected places. Eyes that revealed a new and blessed community that the risen Christ was forming together, a collection unlike any the world had ever seen. And today, on Trinity Sunday, we confess how God ontologically exists as a relational wholeness, a diversity that is not divided, a oneness that is expressed differently and is a mystery that invites our participation, our integration toward perfect completedness, reflecting the same kind of unconditional love and inclusive belonging that occurs in God's own self, that God draws us in and helps us in all of our relationships, including our relationship with ourselves. So, from this perspective and this theological framework, also with the experience of Paul as we have read about it in Romans 8, I offer three short notes for us to consider on this weekend when Americans remember our better aspirations of our national potential and appreciate the sacrifices that have helped us be the very best we hope to be. The first short note, for us to have new eyes and to see the issue of race itself with these new eyes gifted by the Spirit. Maybe you noticed on your worship bulletin cover this morning the picture of these two young girls. This picture was taken without copyright permission, so please don't tell on me, from another cover of the April issue of the National Geographic magazine. These two young girls are fraternal twins and were born on July 3rd, 2006 in Birmingham, England. Their biracial parents gave them intertwining names, Millie Marcia Madge Briggs and Marcia Millie Madge Briggs. Things weren't confusing enough. And if you saw these two twins walking down the street together, perhaps even hand in hand, you would likely label Marcia, who has light brown and fair skin, as being a white child, and her twin sister Millie, who has black hair and brown skin, as being a black child. But as they say, only a mother knows for sure. And their mother, Amanda, is exactly right, saying, it's not about race. It's about genetics. And the pros agree. Skin color, says statistical geneticist Alicia Martin, is not a binary trait. You weren't born white, or others weren't born black, or if you're black, you weren't born black and others were born white, or whatever race that may be. That it's a quantitative trait. And everyone has some gradient on the spectrum. There's no such thing as pure white or pure black or any other ethnicity. By the way, and there's a lot of information in this National Geographic magazine, April 2018 issue. I would encourage you to get a hold of it if you can. But did you know what continent is the most racially diverse in the world? Africa. They've been around a lot longer than anybody else. They've had more diversity in their DNA profile. And it's in that issue, therefore, that tells us that what we do with race, when we label people as being a part of a particular race, we've done so by virtue of social convention. And that race has no bearing, no foundation in historical or scientific proof. In fact, it says exactly the opposite. But what we really need to be thinking about is ancestry, not race. And the code of your ancestry is not something you can tell by your skin color. It lies much deeper, encoded in your very DNA. And what you present as your race to the world is the dominant genes of pigmentation. But really, if you broke down that double helix of our DNA construction, you would find that 99 point some other great number puts us all very much alike. That our differences are narrowly thin. And yet what the history of the world has done with that superficial difference. This DNA holds and locks secrets that may surprise you, that may upset you. I know a few folks in this congregation that have done the cotton swab, check things out. Wonder what you would find. I believe that life in the Spirit of Christ can free us from bias because we are called not to see things merely from a human point of view or using the metaphors of our passage in Romans 8. We are not under an obligation to the flesh or to live according to the flesh, but to live according to the Spirit. A spirit we are obligated to embrace, where we learn there is no condemnation, there is no hostility, but instead is a life filled with abundant peace and everlasting love. People of the Spirit don't have time to hate or to put cruel posts on Facebook or to respond with venom on Twitter. There is no fear in love. And as we are faced with this bias and prejudice that's all around us, lurking in every corner and every dark hole of the internet, and sometimes with a bright light shining, it's helpful for us to respond also as people of love. Not merely in bitter disagreement, but to recognize how that light of redemption has not fully encircled the soul. My second short note then is that we, through the eyes of the Spirit, may see our neighbors in new eyes. The issue of racial harmony and equality in our land is not going to go away anytime soon, if at all. In fact, the numbers say it's only going to grow more pronounced and more challenging. Maybe you're tired of hearing about that National Geographic 2018 issue, but it told me something very alarming or surprising or redemptive. depending on your perspective. In just 2 years, in the year 2020, for the first time in the history of the United States, less than half of the children in the nation will be labeled as white. You don't have to believe me. Show up here on a weekday and go down the childcare hallway. For 10 years, I've called it the United Nations. And we in the white community who have white churches are really going to have to figure out, aren't we, how we include the world's ethnicities into our life of faith together, if we're going to even have a chance with the future. This seems to me, this onslaught of the coloring, if you will, the deeper coloring of the American society, is part of the driver to this resurgence of neo-racism that we have noticed across our land and across Eastern Europe. Five of my black friends on Facebook that are ministers, two in this city and three elsewhere, posted the very same meme on their Facebook timeline. It caught my attention. I saw it so often. And it helped me frame some of the discussion from their perspective that is going on nationally. They posted this. It was never about the anthem. It was never about the flag. It was never about the military. It was about Patrick Harmon, age 50. It was about Philander Castile, age 32. It was about Alton Sterling, 37. It was about Sandra Bland, 28. It was about Anthony Hill, 27. It was about Samuel Du Bois, 43. It was about Blendon Glenn, 29. It was about Freddie Gray, 25. It was about Natasha McKenna, 37. It was about Walter Scott, 50. It was about Christian Taylor, 19. It was about Michael Brown, 18. It was about Eric Garner, 43. It was about Aki Garner, 43. It was 28. It was about Lanquin McDonald, 17. It was about Tamir Rice, 12. It was about Yvette Smith, 47. It was about Sean Bell, 23. It was about Hamidou Diablo, 22. And there's a few more in the list. It was about due process. It was about justice. Now, some of these names you may have heard about. Some of them you may not have. But they're a growing list, unfortunately, of some stories that are just absolutely shocking. Like Stephon Clark, who was shot up to 20 times in his own backyard in Sacramento, California, earlier this year when he was armed with nothing more dangerous than a cell phone. In conversations with one of my closest black minister friends this week, he reminded me, it's never about black people versus the police. That is a smokescreen intended to divide us all. It is about being treated fairly and justly. And in our society, it's the simple fact that when you're black or you have black skin, you are more likely to get into trouble, very serious trouble, very quickly. All it takes is one bad situation with the wrong person, and you know your life is on the line. One of these black ministers asked, "How often do you think about being white? How often a day do you think, I have white skin, I am white today?" My reply, "Hardly ever." His reply, "I think about it every single day, often multiple times a day. When I'm traveling out of town with my family, I think about my black skin. When I send my son out in the car for his very first time, I think about his skin color. Knowing the social conditions we as a society have placed upon assumptions around race, a small amount of conflict can quickly escalate into a death sentence. A key question. Facing our nation, swiftly tumbling toward a pluralism that I'm not sure we're capable of handling is this one. Is the solution really, as a society, to return to increasing separation and segregation? Or can we work toward a more inclusive, equitable, and fair community? I fear many of us are giving up, saying it's no longer important. The mountain's too steep. The job can't be done. These questions still settle in the air. And if we think about the more shameful parts of our own American story, the way we answer this question is not just merely an abstraction. It's vitally a matter of life and death. Seeing with new eyes of the Spirit, ask that I will listen and legitimize the experiences and perspectives of my neighbors who wear brown and black skin, that their problems become my problems. I think we are trying as a congregation, have done enormous work toward this end, but there's just so much more we can and should do. So the final short note I offer, I believe this one to be the most important of all. It may be also the hardest. It asks that we will see ourselves with new eyes. I realized this week, as I was thinking about these topics, that I am guilty of racial profiling. I was parked, well, actually waiting, but felt like I was parked, at a red light at a busy intersection in Lexington. And off to the side here was a young white man wearing a trench coat. Now, there's a lot of reasons he could be wearing a trench coat. It seemed kind of hot to me. Maybe he was fearing the rain forecast that's possible in the bluegrass about this time of year. But I do know this. Throughout that long waiting of the red light to turn so I could move through the intersection, I did not keep my eyes off this young white male in a trench coat. And I was racially profiling him, judging him, assuming things about him, being fearful of him, wondering about what his intentions were, what his future was going to be, and if I was somehow tragically going to be intersecting, not this intersection, but his life in a terrible and difficult way. I noticed I didn't like the way he was carrying his whiteness. Maybe for good reason. Writing for the LA Times, Mike Mills has combed through the records of the Center for Disease Control from 2011 to 2015, the most recent 5 years for which data are available. It meant looking at 2,962 counties of the United States population, nearly 99% of all Americans. According to that data, rates of homicide, gun killings, and illicit drug fatalities are highest in counties where 9 in every 10 residents are white. 99% of our country. Highest rates of homicides, gun killings, illicit drug fatalities are highest when the population of that county has 9 in 10 residents classified as white. Now get this. According to the same data, Correspondingly, the white Americans who are the safest from such deaths are those who live in racially diverse areas such as Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, where 2/3 of the residents are non-white, where millions of immigrants live. Now, I don't really think I'm a racist, but I am. And while I hope to not judge people by the color of the skin, I find that I do. And the real question for me is not always will I listen to someone, but will I stand next to them? Will I advocate what they need to have advocated as a friend, as an ally, as a supporter? Seeing with new eyes invites this reexamination of our history, our future, the openness we have to the struggles of others, our role as the historically dominant race to admit our blindness and resistance to change. It requires an authentic dialogue and intentional strategies at relationship building. It demands new skills and exposure, seeking to put ourselves and our understanding in the shoes of the person whose background, race, experience is different than ours. Calls for new eyes, new heart, a new attitude. So at the end of this experience with Harvey, I'm going to call him Harvey, it's really Harvey, but I'm Kentucky, what can you do about it? I met him and we were talking. He said, "I'm engaged to be married this summer." "Oh," I said, are you going to marry an African?" And this black man who had been afraid of a room full of black people said, "Oh no," with a wide smile. "Not an African, an African American. Change is possible. It is possible indeed."